Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. I'm Reuben Stern. For over two decades, the city of Boonville has played host to a festival that celebrates folk music. Now in its 22nd year, the Big Muddy Folk Festival is once again filling Boonville's Thespian Hall and bringing audiences a variety of acts from across the country. This year's lineup includes, among others, an Appalachian Mountain dulcimer player, a bluegrass band named after an accused cannibal, and a group that celebrates one of the first commercially successful folk acts. Today on Intersection, we'll get a preview of this year's festival, which takes place on April 5th and 6th in Boonville. We'll also explore the legacy of folk music in mid-Missouri and examine efforts to preserve distinctly regional and American musical traditions. And, of course, we'll also get to hear some live music. Joining me in the studio are Dave Pera and Kathy Barton, the husband and wife duo, helped create the Big Muddy Folk Festival. They continue to help run it and will also be performing this year. Welcome, Dave Pera, first.
Well, thank you.
Thanks. Glad to have you with us today. Yeah. Also with us, Kathy Barton. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Glad to have you both in studio with your instruments as well. And we hope that those of you in our audience will join the conversation too. Are you a fan of folk music? If so, we'd love if you shared your passion. So tell us about your interest in the music by giving us a call. Our phone number, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. Remember that 2 to 3 o'clock on Mondays is when we record the program. That's the time to call in. And let's start with this question. Dave, maybe you could help us with this. What are we talking about when we refer to folk music? What does that mean exactly?
Yeah. Well, I have said in the past that folk music in America primarily means two different things. As an academic term, or as the older term, it would be the music that would be traditional to a given community of people. And so an example of that would be old-time fiddle music in Missouri. But then, thanks to people like the Weavers and then really there are people that followed them, like Peter, Paul, and Mary and Bob Dylan, this term folk music became more like a style. It's a style of music. Troubadour picks up the guitar and sings a song that he has written recently about something. And that's really because of people like Peter, Paul, and Mary, that style of music became, you know, very popular. And especially with the time when Kathy and I were both kids, you know, that's some of the popular music that we grew up with. And it was great because even though it was very accessible, you know, you could sing along with it and you could be participating in it right away. And so that's also what the term folk music means. And they can intersect, but they don't all, you know, they not necessarily.
Right. And Kathy, when you think about folk music, which of those do you tend to lean more toward?
I lean toward both, even though I have a real affection for the music from communities. That's been one of my orientations for many years. I spent some time collecting folk songs and ballads from singers in Stone County, Arkansas. I've had a very keen interest in the music from a community, fiddle music, like Dave mentioned, any of those kinds of things, Irish tunes sung in Irish communities, that sort of thing. That's probably where my heart is more. But then again, we sang, Dave and I have sung a lot of songs written by our good friend, the late Bob Dyer, a wonderful historian from Boonville, who wrote great contemporary songs about Missouri history themes. So we do more modern songs, too.
Right. Which, you know, actually I could, because Bob was also one of the founders of the festival when we started putting it together. You know, Bob was the second phone call, but or more or less. And he, you know, we started with it, and Bob emceed with me. Emceed the festival with me until he died. We used to have an argument, sort of an argument with Bob, because Bob knew some old songs, but he really wanted to write his own songs. And every now and then he would say, well, Dave and Kathy sing the old songs, and I write my own folk songs. And Kathy and I go, ooh, you know, can't really say it's a folk song until it's been around a while.
It needs
to
pass through oral tradition. That's another definition of what a folk song is. It has to be passed from person to person over a given period of time.
And what might that time be? How long would it? How many generations removed does a song go from being contemporary to folk?
It wouldn't even have to be that long, and it doesn't really necessarily have to pass through generations, but it has to pass from, you know, person to person. There has to be a process in there, I think. And I think you could make the case that, you know, it could be that one of Bob's songs, River of the Big Canoes, is being sung by a lot of people, will likely be sung years from now. It seems like a lot of people in Missouri have picked up that song, so that would be a good candidate.
Huckleberry Finn has gone through a couple of changes that are, some of them I kind of wish wouldn't have happened, but that's okay. But,
So that River of the Big Canoe song, we actually had Lee Ruth and John Schneller on here a couple of years ago. They sang that song, and we'll get a link to that on our website
after the program today. A lot of people are doing Bob songs, which is a great thing, I think. So.
And, you know, I mean, these are things people can argue about in academic circles, you know, because that's what academics do is they argue about things. you could say, for example, one folklorist I knew declared, you know, Silent Night is not a folk song. Okay, and I think of, you know, Kathy and I think of Christmas as a time when we're all folk singers, because there are certain songs that we all remember at Christmas, or many of us do, and we sing them at a time, you know. And while Silent Night is one of those songs that most everyone can sing, but it has not varied. It's the same melody. It's the same words, I guess the same translation from German, but it has not changed, and yet, you couldn't remove Silent Night from the tradition that it's sung in, and that's part of that. And Bob's songs could very well among the tribe of people here in Central Missouri, you know, that serves a particular tradition for them, perhaps, mm-hmm. you know.
Okay. I want to remind everyone real quickly that, again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the legacy of folk music in mid-Missouri, and joining me in the studio are Dave Para and Kathy Barton, who helped create the Big Muddy Folk Festival, which will take place on April 5th and 6th in Boonville. For those of you in our audience, are there certain folk songs or artists that stand out in your mind? If so, we'd love you to share your knowledge. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection is broadcast live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can be part of our conversation at that time and watch our video stream by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. Interesting where you left off, Dave, the idea of a tribe of people who might keep this music alive. Tell us more about that tribe in mid-Missouri.
That actually stretches back to before I came to Missouri. I think of a particular group it's probably the hippies is what it is. It's the remnants of the old hippie community in Columbia, I suspect, you know, from the 60s on.
And some of that coalesced around certain places, for instance. There used to be a great gathering, this is where Dave and I met, called the Shea Coffee House, that was part of the Presbyterian Student Center mm-hmm. on Hitt Street here in town. And there were a lot of that tribal group that came to that place. That's where I began to really start performing. And Dave was one of the resident managers. At one point, there were just so many people that came. Bob Dyer came, Lee Ruth came, a lot of the community you would call part of that tribe. And as the years went on, you started getting the real traditional musicians coming as well, like Taylor McBain, the wonderful fiddler who lived on Wilkes Boulevard. And he taught a lot of people in that group his traditional fiddle tunes. So it was a real learning ground.
Wasn't one of the Columbia hippies, although he, in his earlier youth, in the cat and the log cabin in Boone County, he probably lived like some of them did at later in their lives.
He was an amazing person to have brought to that community. He was born and raised in a log cabin in Boone County, and he had a very traditional life in a lot of ways, and followed a lot of folk ways, and he taught a lot of his tunes to a good many of us. Dave and I know a lot of his tunes, and mm-hmm. the cool thing is, He's been dead for a good number of years, but every time we play his tunes, it's like you conjure him right up again. Wow. It's That's a wonderful thing.
And are these tunes written down, or are they just you jam together, you learn them, and they move that way?
That's how you mostly learn them. In fact, that's, you know, one of the things in folk music is the oral tradition, and that's really what is meant by, you know, when you pass things down from mother to daughter, you know, that sort of thing. It's the oral tradition. And so you know, there the tunes that Taylor played are written down, but probably not many of his ways of playing them, his own versions of those tunes.
He might have his own little variations.
There are not many.
But yes, you can find many tune collections with tunes like Grey Eagle that he played, or Fork of Deer, or Marmaduke's Hornpipe. You'd find a lot of collections of fiddle tunes with those tunes in it. But Taylor put his own little nuances in it that made it his own way.
Right.
Doing the tune.
Right. Well, we've made it 10 minutes into the show and have not heard any music yet. So I'm going to spin us that way. We have a couple of songs that you've agreed to play today. And I wonder if we could transition into one of those and tell us a little bit about the song. And maybe we can start with the Rattlesnake song is one that we lined up to play today.
Yeah.
It comes out of sort of an Ozark tradition. Yeah?
Well, to us, yes. But it's actually some people have said that it could be the oldest ballad native to America, not a Native American ballad. That would be a different idea. But one of the oldest ballads that, you know, instead of a British ballad that came to America, that some people have argued that this could be the oldest one in America. And it could very well date from the 1760s, an incident where a man was mowing his meadow and was bit by a rattlesnake and died. And so there are variants of that. And then somewhere about 200 years ago, that old song, which was an old song by then, was parodied in the American stage. And so then it became kind of a popularized song in a way. And then there are variants of that. And so the Ozark variant that we know is one of those versions. It was kind of the popular, funny versions, even though it's not particularly funny. I think they were just parodying this old song.
And we actually got this from a field recording of a woman named Noble Cowden from Cave City, Arkansas. This was her version of this. There's lots of versions of this song.
So
in the Appalachians and the Ozarks too. So
I could probably sing some of the verses of an older version, the more serious one, and then we could just go into the Ozark one. How's that?
That sounds great.
So you'll hear a real
change. Quite a contrast.
So again, this is Intersection, and this is Dave Pera and Kathy Barton from Boonville playing a song called the Rattlesnake Song, right?
Yeah. Or then the first one is also known as Springfield Mountain. On Springfield Mountain there did dwell a likely youth known full well, Lieutenant Cushman's his only son. A likely youth scarce 21. One Monday's morning he did go down to the meadow for to mow. He mowed around till he did feel a pison serpent bite his heel. Now when he had received that deathly wound, he laid his scythe down on the ground. To return home was his intent, crying aloud long as he went. His voice was heard both far and near, but none of his friends there did appear, thinking he was our poor Moore laid down and died. something like that. Let's go on to the other one.
And this is the way it changed.
Okay, that was Kathy Barton and Dave Pera performing a song called The Rattlesnake Song,
yes.
A variant of an even older ballad, American folk song. For our listeners out there, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the legacy and current state of folk music in mid-Missouri. Joining me in the studio, Dave Pera and Kathy Barton. 2 decades ago, they helped create the Big Muddy Folk Festival, which still takes place every year in Boonville. For those of you in our audience, have you attended the Big Muddy Folk Festival in the past? If so, we'd love to hear your recollections or any connection you have to folk music. Give us a call. Share your stories. Our number, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org or go online to kbia.org, follow the link for Intersection, and join our live online chat. What do you think the writer of that song would think if he heard the version you just performed?
Which, the original one, you mean?
The more upbeat one, with the musical accompaniment.
The writer of the older one, you mean?
Of either one. I'm wondering how this stuff transitions, because I suspect that what you just performed is not exactly the same as what was originally
written. The original writer probably would have been horrified, because Dave's first version is closer to probably the original, which, as you could tell, by a very serious melody. In fact, a lot of them were set to old religious songs that people would have known. It was making a very important moral point.
Yeah, I actually skipped the last verse of that, which is, you know, be prepared when
prepared.
God does call.
You know.
I skipped that one.
So you can see what happened to it. In fact, we know funnier versions of that where the whole serious moral intent was gone, and now it just becomes something to kind of laugh at.
And
so,
I would
suspect they wouldn't have been very happy.
I think when his wife enters the song, that those are usually the funnier versions. And then sometimes she sucks the poison out of his heel and she has a rotten tooth, and so the serpent kills them both, you know, that sort of
thing.
Or
she sucks the poison out of his heel and then says, I saved you, now you got to marry me. You know, so it has a lot of twist to it, like a lot of ballads do.
So that is actually those are the kinds of things that interest us in older folk songs, is when you know one version, then when you hear a different version, you've got your antenna up and go, oh, so look what's happened now. You know
Dave and I work in schools a lot. We used to do a lot of school residencies, and we would bring some older ballads and have the kids sing some of those. We did one called The Hangman, which is an old ballad that dates, I believe, to the 1500s. And we have kids think about that. That's a long time ago. And it's pretty neat that people are still singing that that particular song. Mm-hmm. And we know lots of songs like that, as a matter of fact, that have been around that long and people are still singing them.
Right. Right.
We think that's fun.
It is. That is a lot of fun. And there's different musical traditions in that, too. But it's interesting that these are not songs that get performed in concert halls and get transcribed and studied in musical institutions the way that a lot of other sort of old music like that is. So a lot of religious music or Bach and some of those old composers as well that are hundreds of years old that we still have in our world today. But this is different, right?
I think really ballads and that kind of the traditional song is studied more in anthropology type of classes, folklore in that way, English courses,
yeah.
You know, that's where the folklore program here at MU is. It's part of the English department. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, it's not the – some of the musical forms are studied in classical – in music schools, but not many. Our old one of the people we had last year – who came to the Big Muddy, Alan Jabour, is a great old-time fiddler, but he was head of the American Folklife Center in Washington, D.C., and head of the NEA for a while. He had quite a career in folklore, but he studied fiddle tunes from the Appalachians, and he told me, he said, you know, when I used to travel around as a guest to the universities, I was always the guest of the English department, the anthropology department, the history department, never the music department.
Interesting.
But then he said there is a younger generation of classical musicians who are reaching back to traditional tunes in ways that are very respectful of the way the tunes are played.
In fact, we know a French musician who's an incredible violinist named Gilles. And Gilles is just renowned worldwide, and he loves American fiddle tunes.
Yeah,
and he learns, he must know hundreds and hundreds, and he loves jamming, just like we do. I mean, the same sort of thing. So it is changing.
And not the first time that's happened either. I mean, the late 1800s, there were a lot of composers in Europe that were doing exactly that. Mm-hmm. They were going out in the countryside and collecting these sort of folk melodies write into symphonies.
And I mean, you do have people like, you know, Aaron Copland is one example who was interested in folk music from the get-go. And that's why you have things like, Aaron Copland's Rodeo, where he used folk music themes. Hop High Ladies of Cakes Aldo or Miss McLeod's Reel was incorporated, as well as a tune called Bonaparte's Retreat, which is very, very...
That's the famous strain.
So, yeah, there have been a lot of classical musicians that have dabbled with that, too. So.
Okay. We'll come back and talk more about that. We have a caller on the line I want to bring into the conversation. Brandon is on the line. Brandon, are you there?
Yeah, how's it going?
Good, good. Thanks for joining our program today and calling in.
I actually met a really interesting individual a couple months ago. His name was Randy Sparks from the New Christy Minstrels, and he actually has been a really big influence on me in getting into some of the folk music that has kind of, for the past, been kind of an oversight for me.
Mm-hmm. And you're getting some nods from our guests here today.
Well, that's
he was a great individual. His music, I mean, it speaks to me. He's a really cool guy too. He's old, but he acts like he's as young as they come.
That's great.
Well, we've never met him.
You're lucky. That was another group that we heard a lot.
Sure.
You know, certainly. They were enormously popular.
And yeah, I didn't even realize it, and I talked to my grandparents about it, and they loved it. And me and him have been corresponding over emails and phone calls, and he's been giving me music to listen to, and it's just been great.
Well, you're very lucky. That's
wonderful.
I'm
curious what music does he get? Is it stuff that his group performed, or is he?
That and also just some of the influences that he's been a part of.
There you go.
Kim Carnes, and he talks about John Denver, and just a really interesting individual.
Hmm.
And he also is going to school now and also putting that stuff back into younger minds. They perform for free at schools just to help keep that kind of folk music alive.
Yeah.
That's certainly been a mission of ours, that's for sure. We want younger folks to know about this kind of music.
Well, Brandon, let me ask you this while we have you on the phone. You seem to be fairly interested in these musical traditions. What got you interested in this?
What got me interested in this?
Yeah.
I've played music my entire life. I've primarily played country and rock and roll, but I actually sell cars here in town, so he was looking for a van, and it was probably the best car selling experience I've ever had.
That's great.
That's
wonderful.
Terrific. Wow.
Great. Well, Brandon, I really appreciate you calling in and joining our conversation today.
Yeah. I mean, if you guys take requests today by the new Christy Minstrels, would be amazing.
Oh, well, it's been been too long for me to do that off the top of my head, but that was a formative influence.
Green Rocky Road.
That would be great, too.
I don't know.
I don't know if I could pull that off, but those are good songs. I listened a little less to them. I was Dave and I were both probably more influenced directly by Peter, Paul, and Mary, but we both
Kingston
had older
Trio,
sisters that had Kingston Trio,
Chad
Peter,
Mitchell
Paul, and Mary,
Trio,
New Los, you know.
We Five.
The Christy Minstrels.
Christy
oh, yeah,
Minstrels,
all of those.
New
things.
Christy Minstrels.
Ian and Sylvia, you think about those. And Joan Baez, you know, big influences.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Big
right.
influences.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of people, I think, and a lot of people go back to Woody Guthrie, you know, being a major influence. But at the same time, they'd rarely go back beyond Woody Guthrie and the songs that, you know, his songs that he wrote. He often used older forms, older songs for his own.
You guys know where you can find those? I mean, in the digital age, because that's something I would love to be able to go back and to find, but I can never find them.
Woody's songs or his roots?
His roots. I can find Woody's songs.
Well, you know, I mean, for example, if you sing, "Oh, my loving Father, do you want to go to heaven?
Sound familiar?
Do you want God's bosom to be your pillow?
Hide me over the rock of ages. Rock of ages cleft for me.
The Carter family. Oh, my loving darling.
How I love you. How I love you. None can tell. In your heart you love another. Little darling. My land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me."
That gives you a pretty good idea.
So you would have to, if you kind of look at the music that was popular during Woody Guthrie's life, I mean, the Carter family is, you can get a lot of things because they were huge in the 40s. They were beaming across most of the country. And so Woody got some things from them, and they were drawing, again, from traditional
sources. Actually, one of the
things
I would recommend for you to look at is folk song collections specifically from Oklahoma, where he was, you know, raised up. I would check some of those, and there's a lot of those out there, and you can see what kind of things were influencing. He used those old ballads to set to his own words.
And the porch music. Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
Brandon, thank you again for calling in and joining our conversation today. We're going to have to head into a break here, but thanks for calling in. I hope others will join our conversation as well.
Not a problem.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Again, our number here is 573-8825. I forgot our number here. Let me call us into the break at 882-8925. Sorry about that. I'm so caught up in the music today. But we are talking about folk music on Intersection with Dave Parrott and Kathy Barton, folk musicians who helped create the Big Muddy Folk Festival in Boonville. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be back after this to hear some more music and talk a little more. So stick around. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about folk music in mid-Missouri and the Big Muddy Folk Festival that takes place each year in Boonville. Joining me in the studio are Dave Pera and Kathy Barton, the husband and wife musical team who also helped create the festival, which this year takes place April 5th and 6th. If you've attended the festival, if you've attended it in the past, and you have some recollections, we'd love to hear those. Or if you have other folk music recommendations or questions, we'd love to hear those too. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org or go online to kbia.org. Follow the link for Intersection, and you'll find our online chat room there. You can talk to us that way as well. We were talking a little bit before the break about the sort of evolution of folk music and how it gets adopted. We were specifically talking about some influences on the big folk musicians that we know from the 60s and 70s. What about going back? I mean, how do we know about what the songs were like 100 years ago as opposed to what we have today?
Go ahead. Well, I mean, there are collections. You know, 100 years ago, there were collectors, especially people like Cecil Sharp came from England and felt that and discovered, you know, versions of British ballads in the Appalachians that were older, that he thought were older than the ones he could currently collect in England. And so he, you know, he wrote them down, and then sometimes the melodies have been recorded, sometimes not. There are other collections that talk about melodies. You're getting there before real field recordings.
But we have lots of collections of folk songs that have been made over many, many years. We have a lot of those books, folk songs from Ohio, specifically a West Virginia collection. Here in Missouri, we had ballads and songs collected by the Missouri Folklore Society, and that was a man named H.M. Belden who was responsible for pulling a lot of that collection together. And Vance Randolph, a wonderful, wonderful collector in the Ozarks, collected not only folk songs and ballads, but jokes, riddles, stories, everything else. And in some cases he talked to people who were, Civil War veterans, even, you know, older Civil War veterans, mm-hmm. who remembered songs that were sung, and he recorded some of those things and transcribed them. So we have a lot of ways to find out what people were saying.
In terms of how they sounded, that is still certain guesswork that you have to think. Now, when we mentioned that piece from that Aaron Copland used, the Bonaparte's Retreat, that one. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that was, the Lomaxes recorded a guy named William Stepp playing that in the 1930s in eastern Kentucky. And William Stepp was a very old man at that time, and he had learned his tunes from his grandfather. And so that repertoire goes back, about 200 years, or close to that, or somewhere in there. And so you would think, well, he probably learned the tune from his grandfather and played it at least considerably similarly to the way his grandfather played, you would think. So those are the kinds of guesses that you make and, look for.
And what was the goal in documenting those things? I mean, was it to try to capture history specifically, or was it to be able to do something with the music?
It had a lot of different motivations, but in many cases it was to capture perhaps what was considered a dying art or a dying culture, perhaps. I mean, there was a time when people thought the folk culture was eroding, so they wanted to document it as much as we could. And there was a time, at the beginning of the 1900s, where people were thinking American Indian traditions were in danger of being completely obliterated. So you, at the same time, you had schools where Indian kids were sent to not be able to speak their own native language anymore and learn English and all those kinds of things. At the same time, you had folklorists interested in capturing the old native traditions. So you have that real...
Preserving the culture was trying to destroy.
Yeah, so it's...
Yeah, and I think in actually when Kathy mentioned the Belden collection and Vance Randolph's collection of Ozark folk songs, I've seemed to
noticed that right around the 30s and 40s, there was some fairly intense collecting going on. And I think it's because people at that time were aware that their way, that the way of life was changing in a way.
Industrialization.
That, yeah, and
what's that doing to the rural culture?
The ways that people used to live for hundreds of years, you know, were going by the wayside. I mean, if you, for example, square dancing, a lot of people will tell you that the automobile killed square dancing, just about killed it off. I mean, you can still do it. But, you know, in the old days, in older days, when you had to pretty much stick around home for entertainment, you know, a lot of people would have square dances in their houses or in their barns or, you know, and that would be a way for a community to be together, and it was a fairly close community. Well, once you can get in a car and drive for 20 miles, you know, you've gone away somewhere. You can do something else. And so square dancing went out of popularity for that, you know, largely for that reason.
Or what else, you know, what's going on with ballad singing? Ballad singing in a lot of cases was to entertain in your community. It was also a way to recount an event. And people had the time to listen. Tell me when you hear ballads sung now in pop media.
Yeah, very
you
rarely.
Don't really as much
rarely.
At all.
I mean, they
do exist.
Yeah.
But it's
they
not
tend to be
common.
More along the Broadway musical number type singing as
that's
opposed
right.
to
that's
a folk song.
Well, the ballad is actually in jazz. That's a jazz term that means a slow love song. But in the folk song in folk music, and
it'll tell a story.
It means it's a song that tells a story.
And it does happen. I mean, you did have the, you know, years ago when we were little, the Ballad of Davy Crockett, and you know, things like that.
Or
were modern songs.
Come and listen to my story about a man named Jed, poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed. Then one day he was shooting at some food, and up through the ground come a bubbling croot. That's called the Ballad of Jed Clampett.
But that's a modern,
that's the name
using,
of that song.
Using that older form. So it does.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah.
You do
to underpin the theme
same.
Of a TV show, right?
Well,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, sure.
Right, for that reason, yeah. For entirely that reason. But, you know, it's also a time when, you know, you have to go back and realize that before any recorded music, if you wanted to hear music, it had to be live. Someone was either going to play it for you or you're going to play it or
yourself.
Sing it yourself. So a person doing chores in the house or work out in the field would sing, you know, especially work songs where people were singing, working together, especially if they needed to be coordinated. You know, there's a whole tradition of work songs. Well, nowadays, I mean, where do you go where you don't hear music?
Piped in.
You know, you just,
if you walk in a grocery store, you're going to hear music piped in.
You turn on KBIA and listen to, you know,
it's
symphony while you're
it's all
dusting
around.
The house or something.
But
like
it's
that.
All around, and Dave's made that's a good point.
You know,
you would have to do it yourself.
But it's an interesting thing, too, that, you know, that idea of the story song, because a lot of pop music throughout the last century and up until now, you know, from the 50s and 60s when we started to have the rise of pop culture, a lot of those songs seem to have turned toward internal emotional expression as opposed to narrative storytelling in the mm-hmm. in the structure of the song. Do folk songs still stick to that idea of telling a story, or is there some of that expressiveness going on?
There's some
on
of that
in,
expressiveness
in
with songs now, that for sure. But
there are always been what have been called, I guess, lyric songs that were sentimental or
oh yeah, that's a big part of the tradition too, is sentimental songs.
Yeah. And actually Vance Randolph as a collector was something of a an innovation or a change, because he was including in his collection of songs from the Ozarks songs that had been written in the 1800s with definite, you know, authors and were popular songs. But Vance felt, well, these are the traditional singers of the Ozarks, and these are their songs that they sing. To them, they don't necessarily make a distinction, so I'm going to include them. But Vance knew the difference, and he delineated them as such. But
yeah,
so he had a broader sense.
You know, you have events, cataclysmic events in this country, that years ago you would have had people creating songs about that event. For instance, you know, Hurricane Sandy.
Right.
would have created. But you're not hearing that kind of thing as much anymore, people telling the story, like the Galveston flood, or many, many folk songs about the sinking of the Titanic. That really hit the American psyche in a lot of ways, and there are many, many songs about the Titanic that came out.
And why do you suppose we're not getting that anymore?
I think it's too diverse now. There's too many media outlets right now.
There are people that are singing. I'm sure someone has written a song about Hurricane Candy. Well, I'm not sure, but I bet you. I'll bet you there's one. So,
but what are the opportunities to get that out, and who would that person be? And it would be just much harder now for you to get a song out like that.
And I mean, where we started at the beginning of the program, people would have to pick that up and start performing it separately from the person who wrote the song for it to really get traction, right?
That's true.
Yeah, exactly.
To make it a traditional song, yes. But, you know, yeah.
So.
Okay. I wonder if we could get another song at this point.
Well, sure.
We had talked about a couple of songs. The other one we had talked about is one called The Bramble and the Rose.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about that.
That was written by a woman named Barbara Keith, who apparently, from what we can understand, recorded one album and that was it. She kind of had a brush with a more popular situation, and she walked away from it. And this one song... was picked up, and it's now being sung by people all over the country. And it sounds like a song that I think should have been picked up by a country singer. It's got all those earmarks, but it gives you an example of a kind of contemporary love song, lyric song. And it uses an old motif, by the way, which comes from the older ballads, the idea of the bramble and the rose. So.
Yeah, it's from one of the classic ballads is the ballad of Barbara Allen, who scorns her lover because he's neglected her, and
he dies of a broken heart,
and then she recants, but it's too late, so she dies of a broken heart, and in from their graves one grows a briar and one grows a rose, and they grow together as a true lover's knot.
And is that the motif there, the idea of the
bramble and the rose?
Yeah. And there is, you know, if you were to study folklore, there is an index of motifs, the Stith-Thompson index of motifs that you're going to study these things that are in there. But I don't know. It doesn't fully play into this song, but just in the chorus.
Each other we will twine.
Okay, that was The Bramble and the Rose, a song written by Barbara Keith and performed by Kathy Barton and Dave Pera. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the past, present, and future of folk music in mid-Missouri and beyond. Joining me in the studio are Dave Pera and Kathy Barton, a musical duo who helped create the Big Muddy Folk Festival in Boonville. For those of you in our audience, we still have a few minutes left for you to join our conversation, so we'd love to hear your recollections or connection to folk music or any questions that you might have for our guests. Feel free to give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. I want to ask you about, you know, the musician's view on keeping these songs alive. Like that song, for example, why did you decide that that's a song you want to perform and that you want to keep alive?
I love the lyric quality to it. I think it has a beautiful melody, and it's just an eminently singable chorus. It just really stuck in my mind, and I like what it says. You know, it's actually a nice song. We've actually sung that song in weddings. Of course, we eliminate the second verse. Now I've hurt you, and we don't do that, but the first verse and the last verse fit very nicely for weddings, so I just really like it all the way around. Nice melody, nice words.
It's nice to sing it together. The intertwine, that word is nice to sing. It kind of, that's...
And I think it caught on for those reasons. I think the chorus is very nice. In fact, we played at a festival in near Albany, New York, and everybody in the audience knew it. And so we had, you know, 100-some people singing along with us, which is a wonderful thing to hear that many people singing with you. That's a good mm-hmm. experience.
And are there other qualities of the songs that keep them alive, that keep them getting chosen by musicians to sing
sure.
over and over again?
I mean, there's a lot of things that would hit. Either the statement in the song, the lyrics would captivate, or in a lot of cases, the melody will captivate. It's got what they would use in country music to refer to the hook. There's something in there, a line, two lines that will stick in your mind, and you just can't get that out of your head. There's another contemporary song that Dave and I do called Didn't I Dance, which people ask us to do over and over again. Mm-hmm. It just sticks there. You cannot get that chorus out of your head.
And there are some songs that are very well written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you just...
Lots.
You know, you just... Sometimes you just want to sing those songs because it's just such a well-written song. And it doesn't really matter how many other... You know, whether or not it'll continue on in tradition, just as long as people appreciate how well a song is written, you know, how well it is, how good it is. So, and that not every song is really good.
I want to ask you something a little different. You've made folk music your life's work.
Yes.
And, you know, the life of a folk singer is sort of both idealized and parodied in our culture, I think.
A mighty win.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, a whole movie that sort of made fun of it. And I wonder if you could tell us, what is it really like to be a folk musician?
I actually really have loved it. I mean, it's. I would tell people who want to make a living doing this, your income level will really, really fluctuate. Up,
yeah, you'd
down.
Really love it.
I mean, but that's you don't do it for money. You're doing it because you have a passion for it. And I've had a passion for this kind of music since I was a little kid. I really love it. I love the fact that a lot of people have had a lot of fingerprints on this music, that it's been passed on for so many years. I think that has a vitality that I really love.
Have to be willing to travel. That's one of the things Kathy and I like.
We think
traveling is fun, and we learn a lot of things when we travel. That try to make as much use of that experience as we can.
And we've met wonderful people through this music that we would never have had an opportunity to meet. I mean, people like the late Grandpa Jones, who was a Grand Ole Opry star, got to know him through our travels and through going to Arkansas and met up with Grandpa Jones and his family. The late Jimmy Driftwood, who wrote The Battle of New Orleans that Johnny Horton recorded. Merle Travis. People like our friend Taylor McBain, just all these wonderful people that I wouldn't take anything for those experiences.
It's probably as a music, because you're still in the music business, you're still an entertainer, and so there are certain qualities to that experience that a lot of people have. I think folk music is probably less competitive than, say, you know, classical music, for example. You know, there's always somebody, you know, claiming to be better than you and wants your seat.
Yeah, I mean, that's all based on virtuosity, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And then, you know, and probably because there's not that much money in it, it's not the rat race. You know, there are not quite as many people ready to screw you, you know, because the reward isn't really there. So you meet a lot of people, you work in venues that are run, you know, by volunteers, you know, people that are, who are also aren't in it for the money. You know, there are a lot of festivals.
Do it for the love of it.
You know, that are people, and even those festivals that make money, they still use a lot of volunteers. So there is kind of a broader folk community in the United States, and, you know, that you see people at different festivals. And
for instance, a very popular venue for folk musicians is the house concert, where literally people will give up their homes and invite people in and set up chairs, and you'll do a concert. That's a perfect setting.
Well, that's
the kind
a
of
very
music we do. A really
traditional
music.
Setting for
it is.
Folk
it
music.
Is.
So.
Well, it's an interesting transition into the Big Money Festival. We haven't talked much about the festival at all, but this has been a great conversation. Aside from that, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the festival. And one of the big questions that I have about that is, how do you decide what gets into a folk festival and what doesn't? And it gets back where we started on this question of what is folk.
Well, we have an orientation that we want to have. In large part, we want to have, remember why I went back to the idea that folk music was music of the communities. We really like to have that, so we will have a representation of traditional fiddling, bluegrass, which is another, you know, type of traditional music, Irish music, we've had Peruvian music, that sort of thing. We will also have the other side of the coin. We will have singer-songwriters somewhat, but I really want to keep a focus in large part on the traditional music. The passed down music, the passed on music. I really want to keep a lot of that focus with it. We try to listen to almost all the acts we book, and try to get a real diversity. I want to expose people to a lot of different musics, from Irish music to blues to Native American music. That we want that diversity in there too.
And how does that work? Do you keep a wish list of I wish we could get these people in the future?
Oh, sure.
And you're always going after them.
And you know, because it's not a large festival. I mean, Thespian Hall seats 600 people, and so it's, you know, it's not 1,000. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I mean, even two nights, the best you're going to do is have 1,200 seats. So because it can't get any bigger, it's not like going outside or downtown Columbia, you know, where you can, you know, literally thousands of people can come to Roots and Blues and Barbecue. You know, you're kind of limited by the venue, and therefore your budget is limited. And so you have to get people who are hopefully coming through, or, you know, people that don't have as big a name or things like that.
And our audience is really like just about any kind of music that we've given them.
Those are the limitations, but, you know, we have had, you know, people, you know, Hartford came one year, and you know, he could draw people from 150 mile radius. People come to see Hartford.
And we've had people like Robin and Linda Williams from Prairie Home Companion. We've had some people that have been on that show.
And what about this year? What are one or two of the highlight acts that are coming in this year?
Well, we have, they're all, actually everybody's new this year to the festival, except for Kathy and me. There's this group called Weaver Mania. That's kind of a tribute band to the Weavers.
Who gave us songs like, you know, Irene Goodnight and Weemawe, which became very popular. You know, they were a wonderful group. And that'll be a wonderful act with a lot of sing-along kind of things, which I think is good.
That's the real folk revival there. And
we've got Eileen Gannon coming from St. Louis, who is an Irish harp player. And that's the first time we've had a harp player. And that should be really nice.
She won the All-Ireland competition for harp.
Which is quite
Irish
prestigious.
Harp. So she's a, you know, world-class player.
We do have a Mountain Dulcimer player named Bing Futch, who is part, you know, he's part Seminole Indian. He'll also play Indian flute, and he's very engaging. And we've got a duo called Notorious, and Larry Unger that plays guitar, and then a woman who plays violin who is just extraordinary. Eden is an extraordinary player.
Yeah.
She'll do everything from old time to klezmer music to, you know, whatever you name, she can play it.
And if people want to go to the festival, what do they do?
Well, you can go to bigmuddy.org. That's the festival website, and you can order tickets there because there are it's reserved seating. There is a phone number. You can call 660-882-7977 and get the office. And during from 10 and 2, 10 to 2 every 5 days a week, and order tickets that way. That's the best way to do it. We haven't sold out completely for a number of years now, so I think if you really just wanted to go and show up, you can probably get a ticket.
We've got a good hall to put it into. It's a Thespian Hall is a great place. Acoustically, it looks good too.
We also have some tickets made available for free to students.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some students who are hearing this and are interested in going. They can call the office and
that's
get
a good
their
point
name.
To make.
And,
yeah.
And we'll get that information linked on our website as well,
okay.
So that we can do that. Now, we're getting to the end of our program here. We talked
Amazing.
About maybe some more music to close us out. So I'm going to thank you once again, our guests today, Dave Pera and Kathy Barton, the husband and wife musical team who helped create the Big Muddy Folk Festival. This year's event, again, takes place April 5th and 6th in Boonville. And like I said, we'll get the details onto our website. So you can go to kbia.org, follow the link for Intersection. You'll find the video of today's program there, along with that information. For those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast, we'd like to remind you that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org. and following the link for Intersection, and there you'll see our video feed. You'll be able to submit your questions and comments, and you can participate in our online chat with others in the audience. We're going to have some music here. I'll talk a little bit while we go out, and then you can keep listening. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute. It's a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Travis McMillan is our studio director, with production assistance from Elizabeth Hayden. Pat Akers, our audio producer. I'm Ruben Stern. I'd like to thank you for joining us. Have a great week.